Chapter 2. The Move to Nevada. Throughout the 1990s and early 2000s, Whittemore was the supreme legislative lobbyist. He represented the gaming, tobacco, and liquor industries. He could get legislators to pass the legislation his clients wanted and then help the same legislators finance their next political campaigns. Las Vegas Review, February 26, 2012. Sparks, Nevada, early June 2006. Judy Mikovits first met with Harvey and Annette Whittemore at the Red Hawk Resort and Country Club in Sparks, Nevada. Red Hawk was a place with preternaturally green golf courses rimmed with mountain views, dining areas with tasteful stonework and towering wood pillars, and a luxe yet earthy aesthetic. Even the restaurant's house wines were from La Terre, the Earth Winery, a reminder that patrons were in a verdant but obviously man-made paradise. The juxtaposition of green fairways and the arid desert was one Harvey seemed to love as a Nevada developer. Other regions of the country had transitioned from dust bowl to arable plains, from marshy tall grass to farmland, and this process of revamping unruly land often involved both visionary thinkers and sometimes a heavy human hand. Sparks sat about 30 minutes east of Reno, and many initially thought it was a crazy location for a city. It was plunked right in the middle of the desert, where average rainfall was less than 8 inches per year. Economic growth in Reno in the 1950s had created a rising demand for low-cost housing, and Nevada was known for risk-takers seeking unexpected payoffs. Developers successfully grabbed water rights to divert streams from the Sierra Nevadas that towered to the west, thus allowing the city to prosper. The approximately 90,000 people of Sparks were housed in a neat layout around the centrally located tower for John Asquaga's Nugget Casino, which was understatedly flashy by Nevada terms. Nevadans often joked, "Reno is so close to hell you can see Sparks." Water rights, being so central to life and property and a protected commodity in the West, could be harder to secure than cattle in modern-day Nevada. The Silver State might as well have been named after the battle over silvery streams and rivers. When her car glided closer to the Red Hawk Resort, it was difficult to be unimpressed by the sheer audacity of what Harvey Whittemore had pulled off in the high desert. The resort at Red Hawk sat on land that had originally belonged to George Wingfield, who during his 63 years in Nevada had been a miner, banker, rancher, investor, and, like Harvey Whittemore, a developer and political power broker. Harvey and his fellow developer David Loeb chose to preserve the original ranch house of the man nicknamed King George, when they built their resort among the sage, reeds, and rushes, where Wingfield had once set his duck blinds and raised Labrador retrievers in the shadow of the nearby Para Mountains. In the spring of 1997, Harvey and his partner opened the first of their two golf courses, the Lakes Course, designed by the famed golf architect Robert Trent Jones II. Sitting upon Audubon-certified protected natural wetlands and featuring natural lakes, murmuring springs, and cottonwood trees, the course was designed to embrace the idyllic landscape. In the ensuing years, the Lakes Course was named Best Golf Course in Reno 7 times by the Reno Gazette Journal. In 2001, Harvey's group built a second course designed by player-turned-golf architect Hale Irwin. Then they broke ground on a permanent clubhouse and a variety of residential options ranging from large homes to condominiums. Mikovits immediately noticed the respect bordering on reverence that the employees seemed to have for Harvey and Annette. Later, she noticed glimmers of nepotism in the same Whittemore mirage, as she learned that many of the employees at Red Hawk were the children of close friends or even family members. In person, Harvey could be considered a physically intimidating man, standing well over 6'4", his reddish hair cropped and thinning, almost military style. He also had a well-trimmed goatee, giving him a rebellious look for a businessman, and adding to the waft of celebrity that followed him around Red Hawk and beyond. Harvey's office was mightily extravagant. An enormous bay window overlooked the lake's course, and autographed sports memorabilia ornamented the walls along with flat-screen TVs. In many meetings to come, Mikovits would typically join the Whittemores in a small conference room. Before the meetings started, a waiter typically slipped in to ask if they needed drinks or food. This first meeting, however, they met in the evening in a conference room right off of the restaurant where they could dine properly on the restaurant's new American cuisine. On the heels of the recent Barcelona conference, they were joined by Dan Peterson and Dr. Greg Perry, a professor at the Department of Microbiology and Immunology for the University of Nevada, Reno, UNR. In 2010, Perry would become chair of that department. During the meeting, the Whittemores first proposed to Mikovits their idea of starting a research institute in collaboration with UNR. They believed an institute dedicated to all aspects of neuroimmune disease, one that could encompass the work of the HHV6 Foundation under the auspices of a common academic home, was the best approach to streamline the research and bring scientific powerhouses together. Perry thought it was a terrible idea, even though the Whittemores had envisioned him as perfect for the job of research director. Perry told the Whittemores if he was involved in a significant capacity, his salary alone would cost somewhere north of $250,000 a year. But Perry didn't want the job anyway. Even with his protests, he did remain interested enough to show up at WPI parties, and he would later join its scientific advisory board after Mikovits was fired. With Perry declining the offer to be research director of a still-not-yet-existent WPI, the others agreed that Mikovits should spend the summer commuting to Peterson's office to learn about the disease and begin laying out plans for the WPI. Her routine quickly fell into place. She took a Southwest flight early Monday mornings, spent the week working at Peterson's office at Incline Village, then flew home to be with David on Friday night. This would remain her routine before the WPI acquired laboratory space from the university. One Friday, as Mikovits flew back to Southern California, she thought of what she had learned over the week about Andrea Whittemore. Annette later wrote a long and thorough article, which gave much of her daughter's history as well as the rationale for the founding of the Institute. It was published in the June 2010 issue of Molecular Interventions. She wrote of Andrea coming down with a mono-like illness in 1989, months of flu-like symptoms, and symptoms including tachycardia, abnormal heart rate, swollen lymph glands, muscle pain, and night sweats. The doctor diagnosed the condition as being psychological in nature, which seemed ridiculous to Annette. In November of 2009, shortly after the publication of the article by Mikovits and her team in Science that showed an association between the XMRV retrovirus and ME-CFS, Andrea Whittemore Goad went public with her story on a Facebook posting for the WPI. "My name is Andrea Whittemore Goad," she wrote. Until last year, I was uncomfortable telling my story to complete strangers. But now, if this is what it takes for all to understand the severity of this disease, I will. She recounted how, as a young girl, she'd had a poor reaction to a DPT booster, and that in fourth grade she came down with a mono-like illness after a tonsillectomy. After the surgery, she had gastrointestinal problems and tachycardia, and none of the doctors could tell her parents what was wrong. But the medical professionals were scared. One psychiatrist told her to get out of her office because she didn't want to catch what Andrea had. Another told her parents that Andrea was school phobic. Annette continued the story in her Molecular Interventions article. A neighbor suggested they visit a Peterson who had treated patients from the Incline Village outbreak of 1984 and 1985. Peterson turned out to have a good understanding of the disease, and although his treatments seemed to provide mostly symptomatic relief, Andrea made slow but steady progress under his care. Her mother elaborated. She continued this modest improvement until she decided to enroll at the University of Nevada, Reno. The admission policy required the measles, mumps, and rubella (MMR) vaccination prior to starting classes. Within 5 days of the MMR vaccination, Andrea had a severe relapse and never regained her previous level of health. Andrea's Facebook post recounted that her reaction to the MMR vaccination left her confined to a wheelchair. Over the next several years, the family tried numerous strategies to improve Andrea's health, without much luck, until Andrea was 21 and they stumbled upon Ampligen, a substance that acts to stimulate the body's antiviral defenses. Compared to other treatments, for Andrea it was a godsend, a gift she didn't take for granted, since she was one of the very few patients with access to the drug under controlled trials. She took Ampligen off and on for 8 years. While taking Ampligen, Andrea improved to 75% of her previous levels of energy and stamina. But despite many of the positive outcomes, she continued to fall ill with opportunistic infections. For unknown reasons, Andrea began to develop reactions to Ampligen, making her too sick to continue. In 2006, when Mikovits first started working in Nevada, Andrea was doing relatively well, although there were clear indications that the Ampligen was producing less than a full recovery. This had also been true of early monotherapy for AIDS, where stumbles and severe relapses often followed improvements. When Mikovits first arrived at Peterson's office in Incline Village to begin her investigation, she encountered her new staff, 3 summer student interns, waiting for her. The crew included David Pomeranz, who later went on to USC Medical School, and Byron Sue, a young man from Berkeley, both hired from a job listing on Monster.com. The third member was Katie Hagen, whose mother was a friend of Annette's. After talking with David, Byron, and Katie for a few minutes, it became clear that none of them knew much about science in a research setting. Yet they all seemed like motivated, brainy greenhorns, and Mikovits had often worked with similarly raw students at the National Cancer Institute. She enjoyed the challenge and energy associated with new learning and often found that their inexperience could be a positive as they would work hard to master the right techniques, entering with what Buddhists call a beginner's mind. In their previous discussions, Mikovits remembered Peterson talking about his repository of samples. She had already compiled a mental list of investigative studies which might be conducted with them. Things were moving forward. There had been a meeting with Dr. John McDonald, who at the time was dean of the medical school, and Harvey and Annette had already started meeting with state and national politicians about the feasibility of putting an institute together at UNR. Mikovits asked Byron to find a few patient samples using dates and patients from the original table Peterson had showed in Barcelona, especially the ones with mantle cell lymphoma, MCL. Then she started discussing with David and Katie what they would need to do to build an Excel data sheet to match the critical records from each of the patients to their samples in the repository. It seemed to Mikovits that Byron had only been gone for just a minute or two when he was back. "I think you need to see this," Byron said. Mikovits followed Byron down the hallway to a small room which held a large deep freezer about 6 feet tall by 3 or 4 feet deep and just as wide. Byron opened the freezer, and Mikovits saw it was filled from top to bottom with plastic bags containing tubes with written names and birth dates scribbled on the side of each tube. "Oh my God, this is the Great Repository?" Mikovits thought. Many of these samples had in all likelihood been logged prior to the more stringent privacy laws. From a scientific standpoint, there were more significant problems. Freezing whole blood destroyed evidence of RNA viruses and the even more delicate RNA messenger molecules whose importance was just beginning to be understood, leaving behind only DNA. Mikovits and her new team drove down to the local grocery store and bought a block of dry ice, a few bottles of isopropanol, and cotton swabs. The interns would start the summer by rubbing the names off of thousands of tubes, putting dates and identification numbers on them as required under the more stringent privacy laws, and building the information into Excel files. Mikovits would start by contacting the patients, making arrangements to draw new, fresh blood, properly harvested. On one of her weekends back in Southern California, she stopped by Epigenex. She got permission to take some extra pipettes, bottles of Trizol, vials that could withstand being cryogenically frozen, and reagents which would allow the samples to be frozen without destroying the nucleic acids. The repository may not have been what she expected, but Mikovits would make sure that this new repository was a resource they could trust to answer their most challenging questions. The first hypothesis Mikovits came up with was that they might be able to find a biomarker of a viral infection in the sampled patients by measuring the ability to produce alpha interferon from plasmacytoid dendritic cells, PDCs, introduced into a patient culture sample. PDCs are immune cells circulating in the blood. A healthy individual will produce large amounts of interferon from their PDCs when exposed to retroviruses like HIV. These cells can be harvested from blood, and the amount of interferon they produce can be measured. Frank Rossetti had done some of the original work on PDCs and human retroviruses, and had a good store of the cells. Mikovits was able to get fresh primary PDCs and the interferon-producing PDC cell line, CAL1, and use them to test patient samples. To her surprise, none of the samples were pumping out interferon. It was an interesting finding, as PDCs infected with HTLV-1 did not produce interferon either. A key part of the immune response was disabled in ME/CFS patients, just as in HTLV-1, which caused cancer and neuroinflammatory disease. Mikovits and Rossetti were both intrigued. Mikovits spent a good deal of time taking data from patients about their maladies. During this time, she also did consulting work for a biotech company that had developed a unique chemokine-cytokine multiplexed assay. She used this test that measured inflammatory markers, usually a sign of infection, on the patients. In addition, she checked their levels of natural killer, NK, cell activity, and RNase-L, other indicators of an abnormality in the innate immune systems of ME/CFS patients. When using the cytokine-chemokine profiling test, Mikovits later recalled that it was consistent with a viral infection. It didn't have to be a specific virus. It's just what we found when we ran the original viral expression microarray experiments that same summer. There was a highly dysregulated expression of RNase-L. There were various levels of significant expression for many different kinds of virus. It really didn't matter. Lots of HHV6, lots of enteroviruses. So much noise that I did remark that these people looked like AIDS patients. She was not the only person to make the clinical observation that ME/CFS patients resembled people with AIDS. Before HAART therapy for AIDS patients, when AIDS Dementia Complex, ADC, often went unchecked, Dr. Anthony Komaroff of Harvard University published a vivid paper that compared the brain SPECT scans to measure blood flow of patients with ADC, ME/CFS, and unipolar depression to controls. Komaroff's images showed well-lighted brains in depression and the control group, with the illuminated red, orange, and yellow tones representing blood flow to various areas of the brain. But an optically stunning near lights out in ADC and ME/CFS that was shockingly similar, as if a violent storm had knocked out the power grid in two neighboring states. That summer, Mikovits called Rossetti and told him that among Peterson's patients, she had encountered a 15-year-old and a 30-year-old with shingles. "That's ridiculous," Rossetti replied. "They'd be AIDS patients." "Yeah, exactly what I was thinking." Since the patients weren't dying en masse as they did with AIDS, Mikovits knew it couldn't be the HIV retrovirus. But what if it was another retrovirus, leading not to the predictable degeneration and death of untreated HIV/AIDS, but to a chronic long-term disease, characterized by a loss of cellular energy and a lowering of the defenses of the body's immune system, as in the slower-moving retrovirus HTLV-1. That would explain why patients presented with pathogenic co-infections, just as AIDS patients did, as well as with cancers that often seemed to develop after decades of being sick. Cancers were, of course, associated with both the retroviruses HIV and HTLV-1, though with AIDS in the years before aggressive therapies, they took a swifter course, and AIDS was even once called the gay cancer due to the unlikely appearance of Kaposi sarcoma, KS, in younger gay men before AIDS was defined, when KS at that time was thought to primarily target older Jewish men. Retroviruses are a family of ribonucleic acid, RNA, viruses, which contain the enzyme reverse transcriptase. The virus enters a cell, uses the reverse transcriptase to direct the cell to create viral deoxyribonucleic acid, DNA, which then integrates into the DNA of the host cell. The virus thus becomes part of the DNA of many of the cells of an infected person. Retroviruses had documented transmission through sexual contact, exposure to infected blood or blood products, or passage from an infected mother to her newborn child during gestation, delivery, or even breastfeeding. Retroviruses are transferred via body fluids, rather than by a vector such as a mosquito or a tick. Mikovits thought about the infections, conditions, and cancers associated with HIV infection. HIV causes problems by damaging the immune system, leaving it vulnerable to other organisms that can cause disease. The majority of people infected by HIV first develop a flu-like illness within a month or two of infection, often suffering fever, muscle soreness, headaches, swollen glands, and chronic diarrhea, similar to the relatively common flu-like onset of ME/CFS. Latent infection can last from 8 to 10 years, giving some patients in the early years of the pandemic the illusory impression that something they were doing was staving off the progressive decline. Similar misattribution has at times impacted ME/CFS patients due to lack of viable treatments, or more commonly, led to many claims from outsiders of pseudo-cures, which can thrive when an illness's course is unknown. Some with HIV develop full-blown AIDS sooner, and others later. Usually, after one has been infected for 10 years, the patients suffer from night sweats, fevers which last for weeks, weight loss, headaches, and chronic diarrhea. In poor nations, those with HIV/AIDS commonly develop tuberculosis. HIV/AIDS patients are also more susceptible to salmonella, cytomegalovirus, candida, cryptococcal meningitis, and inflammation of the membranes and fluid surrounding the brain and spinal cord, Toxoplasma gondii, a parasite spread by cats, and Cryptosporidium, a parasite which lives in the intestines and bile ducts, leading to chronic diarrhea. One of the common neurological disorders is AIDS dementia complex, which usually leads to behavioral changes and diminished mental functioning. Mikovits couldn't help but think about the mental and cognitive changes associated with ME/CFS, such as memory loss, drop in IQ, problems on neuropsychological testing, word-finding difficulties, computation problems, and many others. Considering all the clues, and in light of early observations that ME/CFS had overlap with AIDS, it seemed they were on the trail of a retrovirus. Early in her work at Peterson's office, he advised her to be extremely discreet about whom she saw in the office. She was starting to learn the politics of ME/CFS. Mainly, that if you had it, you didn't want anybody to know. Peterson, given his prominent role during the first modern outbreak of 1984 and 1985 in Incline Village, was known as the doctor to the rich and famous. Mikovits was amazed at the small but steady flow of Hollywood actors and professional athletes who came through Peterson's office to get some relief from the disease. If one saw somebody famous in the waiting room, the protocol was to act like the person was like any other patient there. That came easily to Mikovits, as she never fancied herself a fan of anybody, and even if she found herself in an elevator with a favorite baseball player, she would let him have his privacy. When she wasn't talking about science or doing her volunteer work, she was actually a quiet person. She knew this would no doubt surprise many of her colleagues, who often referred to her as Tsunami Judy for the torrent of words that could pour forth from her when she was excited about a subject. Since it was summer, the Whittemores were typically in residence at their home in the Glenbrook neighborhood at Lake Tahoe. Past the double-gated security checkpoint, residents often drove around in golf carts, and the houses all had names. The historic name of the Whittemore home was the Lakeshore House and resembled a two-story southern mansion with an enormous wraparound porch, a beach where one could swim out into the cove, and a private dock out back where Harvey had several boats. Mikovits enjoyed the life at Glenbrook, often walking out on the dock just as Harvey was pulling up in his new 30-foot powerboat, while an employee grabbed the line. Harvey would tell her and anybody else who might be on the dock to go ahead and jump in, and they'd speed off across the enormous alpine lake. Sometimes they would get all the way to the California side, tie up the boat at Jake's on the Lake restaurant, have dinner and drinks, for which Mikovits never saw the bill, and then hop back in the boat and race home. It was a lifestyle to which anyone could become accustomed. There were some townhomes located next door, and the Whittemores bought one to host their friends and their children. The townhouse had a high loft with large windows and a reading cove, where Andrea would often sit with a book while her family's guests enjoyed the beach. Mikovits couldn't help but think it was due to Andrea's condition and not wanting to provoke what many ME/CFS patients called a crash, caused by overexerting her limited supplies of energy. Down the road about a mile and an easy walk was the barn, which was owned by somebody else, but was where the Whittemores held most of their social events and political fundraisers. It was once an actual barn, but had been completely renovated with nice wooden floors, a bar, picnic tables, pinball machines, basketball hoops like the ones at a county fair, antique Coke machines, which would dispense the soda in their classic hourglass-shaped bottles, and horse saddles and other farming implements on the walls displayed like pieces of fine art. The Whittemores were also crazy about sports, a passion they shared with Mikovits. They had a skybox on the 50-yard line for the University of Nevada Reno football games, seats on the floor for basketball, and season tickets for the Reno Aces, a minor league baseball team. Mikovits couldn't help but notice that Harvey's seats at Aces Stadium were in front of those for Dean Heller, the Republican senator for the state who served alongside Senator Harry Reid in Washington, D.C. Not far away from those seats were those for Congresswoman Shelley Berkeley, who would unsuccessfully challenge Heller for his U.S. Senate seat. Nevada's circle of power was small, and now, working for the Whittemores, Mikovits had a front-row seat to it all. Over the 4th of July holiday in 2006, Judy and David went to Hawaii, but Judy wasn't participating in the Aloha spirit. Instead, she spent the whole time parked in a cozy cabana chair with her silver laptop from Epigen X writing grant proposals. Loomis, Whittemore, and Peterson would then determine if they could fund the research or if they could present it to one of their wealthier patients who might be interested in funding. It was an abnormal life for a researcher, but one that was becoming common for many scientists. As government sponsorship of science declined, the public was often left to fill the gap. As Mikovits settled further into her weekly routine, the Whittemores arranged for her to get a free dorm room at Sierra Nevada College, which was close to Peterson's office. Occasionally, the Whittemores would treat Mikovits to a few days in a luxurious condominium at Red Hawk. The condos were large, with lavish marble appointments and beautiful faucets and sinks. There were always big soft robes and towels, as well as fancy hand soaps and lotions. The attention to detail and elegance was almost intoxicating. Mikovits could go down to the restaurant or swimming pool and know she would be waited on hand and foot. Mikovits had a friend, a co-worker from the National Cancer Institute in Frederick, Maryland, who lived in Reno and was a professor at the university. On a couple of occasions, the two would meet at Red Hawk and they'd spend time at the swimming pool. While Mikovits's friend didn't personally know the Whittemores, she knew of them and told Mikovits that the Whittemores had a good reputation among her colleagues. Several times that summer, the Whittemores took Mikovits to dinner at David's Grill at Red Hawk. They might start off with crab cakes with California pepper aioli or just dive right into a fettuccine Alfredo with a gluten-free pasta option. Many prominent business people and local politicians would often drop by the table to say hello to the Whittemores. Harvey would always introduce Mikovits as their dear friend who was helping them with Andrea's disease and his wife's institution. And a few times they'd jokingly say they were trying to make her family. Their family was so admirably close-knit and accomplished that it was hard not to be warmed by those words, and Judy Mikovits was already starting to feel like part of the Whittemore clan. The summer was ending, and Mikovits wasn't sure what she should do, but she had to transition from the luxuriant summer of powerboats and her young assistants into something more stable. She had an offer from a biotech company for whom she had been consulting recently. The company had some natural product drugs which were close to clinical trial for cancer treatment, and they offered her a lucrative compensation package to become the vice president of research. And while she had loved her summer staff and the patients, she didn't exactly know if this institute would ever get off the ground. Then there was the problem of funding. The research community didn't seem to believe ME-CFS was a priority, so there were lots of appeals to wealthy individuals or families who might have a loved one with the disease. The begging for philanthropy is a constant curse of a maligned illness, but ME-CFS had the additional curse of patients being too sick to pound on doors, or to march through the streets and shout funding demands through a bullhorn. "Harvey, you can't let her leave," Annette had pouted when Mikovits had told Annette she was considering another opportunity. "Make her a good offer so she'll stay." Harvey asked Mikovits what it would take to keep her. Mikovits said she wanted a 5-year guaranteed contract, as one would see for a valued player in baseball, and the ability to keep their beach home in Oxnard because that's where they planned to retire. If she did take the job in Reno, they'd want to become full members of the community by purchasing a small home or condominium. Harvey asked if she'd withhold making a decision for a while to see if he could use his influence and make some things happen. Mikovits agreed to give Harvey some time. By a happy coincidence, Frank and Sandy Rossetti had been invited to UNR by one of their former colleagues from the NCI to give a seminar at the end of the month. Mikovits thought it would be a perfect opportunity for him to meet the Whittemores and weigh in on the long-term prospect of her continuing to work for them. Not that she had taken his advice in the past. When she'd met and married David, Frank Rossetti had told her it was a bad time to leave the NCI and try to get into the biotech industry. He had advised against her signing with Epigenex, and he'd also advised against going to work for the HHV6 Foundation. Reno, Nevada, October 31st, 2006. As Frank Rossetti and his wife Sandy drove to the Whittemore's house in Glenbrook, Frank considered how far his dear friend had come in the 23 years since he had hired the protein chemist who could not find a cell under a microscope. But even though she'd left the East Coast for the West, Frank and Judy still talked on the phone several times a week. In the years they'd worked together, Judy had become like family, occasionally babysitting their only son so that Frank and Sandy could have a night out at the Shakespeare Theater. Now, in this momentous decision of her life, whether to take a job as the research director of an institute which hadn't even been built, she wanted Frank and Sandy to come and check it out. Frank liked the Whittemores and felt the offer to Judy was a fair one. He was impressed with the Whittemores' friendliness, how unpretentious they were, and their dedication to finding answers for the ME-CFS that plagued their daughter. It all culminated in a small, simple dinner with the Whittemores at the Lakeshore House along with Mikovits and her husband, and Dr. Peterson and his wife, Mary. The Whittemores cooked spaghetti and garlic bread and tossed a salad while the guests hovered about them in the kitchen and played Trivial Pursuit. Mary was an educator and an aspiring playwright like Frank. Everyone was enjoying a casual moment so comfortable it seemed they'd been friends for years instead of just meeting a few hours earlier. After the meal was over, Frank took Harvey aside and gave him the third degree. What were Harvey's motivations? What did he want to get out of this? Harvey replied that his daughter was now in her mid-twenties and had been ill since she was 12 years old. Money could do a lot of things, but if your child was sick, how much did that matter? His taut face belied a father's anguish that his daughter had lost her most carefree years to illness, with no end in sight. Harvey seemed to know a great deal about local history, and Frank was pleased that Harvey had interests beyond business. Frank thought he glimpsed a man who relished intellectual combat when he asked Harvey if he knew where the namesake of the city of Reno was buried. Harvey knew the city was named after Union General Jesse Reno, who died in the Civil War, but didn't know where he was buried. His grave is in Frederick, Maryland, near the National Cancer Institute, Frank told him, a little smugly. He died at the Battle of South Mountain. I've been there a couple times. Frank could see Harvey was slightly unnerved that he had known a bit of Nevada trivia that Harvey didn't. Harvey was clearly a man who didn't like to lose. That could be a good thing. They talked for a while longer, and then Frank abruptly said, "Harvey, this has been a lovely evening, but I must confess to a sense of disappointment." "Why's that?" Harvey asked, slightly taken aback. "I've always believed, like the French philosopher Balzac, that behind every fortune lies a great crime. And during this time, you've made a lot of progress in disabusing me of that notion." They had a good laugh over that. When Frank and Sandy were at the airport the next day, Judy called him on his cell phone. "What should I do?" she asked. "Take the damn job," he grumbled. She followed his advice, as she said she would. Frank later lamented it was the worst advice he had ever given anyone.